Yeah. Hey, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Don. My sobriety date is March 17th, 1994, St. Paddy's Day. My home group is the world-famous Monday Night Speakers Meeting in sobriety capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Prior to that, been a member of that group for probably 5 years, although I've been going since they started it. I was a member of the Hopeful Group for a long time before that. So it's funny, Nikki. First, I'd like to thank Nikki for asking me to speak, and I'd like to thank the group, Tampa YPG, for having me come and speak. And she asked me probably a month and a half ago or something, and I put it in the back of my head. And then a week or two ago, she reminded me. And, you know, whenever I get asked to speak, the challenge is to deal with my mind, and because my mind just wants to go to, you know, I want to say this, and I'm going to say that, and I want to come up with these bullet points, and I really want to hammer that. And I was like, really? No, I don't. And I'm a firm believer that I don't use cue cards. I don't, you know, practice. I none of that. For me, it's really important, you know, to be here in the moment and to allow spontaneity to, you know, to use me. So, I do not do that. But she had mentioned that she had listened to a tape of mine from a year ago or something. I spoke on my 20th anniversary, and I thought about listening to that tape. Oh yeah, you know, I can listen to that. And why would I do that, you know? So I can come up here and, you know, I'm sober here today, right now. And so I'll tell a little bit about my story. Drunkalogs are real important to me. I like Drunkalog. I don't want to get lost in a Drunkalog, because that can happen too. But if I don't establish who and what I really am and some credibility with the alcoholic, then what else do I have to offer? Right? I mean, I'm a firm believer in that. You know, before we ever had 12 steps, before we had any literature, paraphernalia, and all the supporting stuff that goes to AA today, before any of that, we had one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic what it's like to be powerless over alcohol, to have that important job interview tomorrow, be really excited, and to know that I can't drink, and that to stop and convince myself that, well, I'll just have one, you know, just have one, and I never just had one. So a little bit about who and what I am. I'll be 52 in March. I can't believe that. I certainly didn't plan to live this long. I thought 30 was the maximum. But I'm from Quincy, Mass., so shout out to the guy from Boston area. I've been down here since 86. I'm an only child. My parents were young when they had me, like most parents, and they were kind of hippie-ish. I was born in 62. I remember wanting to go to Woodstock with them in 69, and they're like, no. And they did acid and, you know, whatever. They weren't big drinkers. There wasn't a lot of booze in the house. So through this process of inventories, the fourth step and the fifth step and the tenth step, and, you know, continuing to try to look within, I've learned quite a bit about who and what I really am, and I'm continuing on that, you know, trying to. My sponsor, Tommy, is always talking about trying to have an encounter with myself, to try to get. We read How It Works, and it mentions honesty 5 times in there, and they're not talking about cash registry honesty or whatever that is that I hear people talk about in discussion meetings. You know, it's honest is honest is honest, and that's hard. You know, it's one thing, I've come a long way in being more honest than I ever was, but I was well practiced at deceiving people, places, and things when I first got sober. And make no mistake about it, just because I've been sober a collection of years, it still can be a challenge. It's not like, you know, I really wanted going through the steps to be like a lobotomy. You know, I was looking for a surgical approach to cut the alcoholism out of my brain so I could just do it, get it done, and move on. And that's not been my experience, you know, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But so I grew up outside of Boston, and so through this process of inventories and looking at who and really what I am is one of the things that I came to understand, that long before I ever picked up a drink, I had an obsessive mind. And you know, they tell me, and I believe this, that alcoholism is a threefold disease. It's a physical allergy, possibly, Silkworth talks about, that something happens to me metabolically when I take a drink. My body craves more alcohol. It's an obsessive mind. It's the mind that will tell me that this time it'll be different, or if I stop drinking tequila and only drink Budweiser, it'll be different, or if I only drink on the weekends, it'll be different. It's a mind that tells me that when anybody else could watch a YouTube of my life condensed into 2 minutes and go, geez, dude, you know, you don't drink real well, do you, you know? But I can't see it, you know. It's like I have the permanent filter on YouTube of my brain, anyway, so so I had this obsessive mind, and the third part of that is a spiritual brokenness, spiritual bankruptcy that wasn't saved, wasn't solved by me, for me, by finding Jesus. I've been saved a dozen times, baptized on TV and most grandiose ways, and you know that seems to work for other people, and that's awesome. I'm not here to talk about what works for other people. I'm here to, you know, that's another important thing for me too, is that I have to remind myself I'm never qualified to use the word you or even we in a meeting. I really bristle at that. All I can be is an expert on my own experience, strength, and hope. That's all I have to offer. You know, no matter, I can memorize the book. There's no PhDs in AA, but although I see people that look like they're striving for that, and more power to them. But there isn't. You know, there isn't. There's only today. You know, give us today our daily bread. It's not the rest of my lifetime bread. It's one day's worth of bread. That's the prayer we say, right? And that's how I have to approach my sobriety, that the stuff I did yesterday is progressive and it gets better and it gives me more power today, etc., but it's still yesterday. And if I'm unwilling to do what I need to do to stay sober right here, right now, then yesterday's meaningless. And tomorrow is just a promise. It's not reality. I can't breathe air right now in preparation for tomorrow, so I can be lazy and not breathe tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm going to have to breathe. And so, like, the air I breathe right here, right now, is the most important. And I have to approach my recovery like that, one day at a time. Anyway, so that spiritual bankruptcy, for me, has been solved through the process of the steps and continued disciplined approach of using the steps in my life and doing stuff I don't want to do and, you know, a number of other things that I'll try to touch on. But so I had that obsessive mind before I ever picked up a drink. I was fairly broken as a kid. I learned, I'm theatrical, right? And I learned how to put a mask on and pretend to be happy and try to get you to like me and try to present myself in ways that I thought you would accept me, because I was convinced that everybody else was cool and I sucked. You know, I'm broken and I don't know what's the matter, but maybe if I wear different color shoes and, you know, whatever, it's just madness. And so that obsessive mind manifested long before I ever had a drink. My first earliest obsessions, I can look back, I've been a people pleaser my entire life, trying to convince, trying to persuade, trying to sell. You know, I'm not here to sell AA, by the way. You know, sometimes I forget that too. It's an attraction, it's not promotion. I can't persuade people to get sober. It's an organic thing that has to happen within the individual. So that's what's the importance of a drunkalogue, is that the identification can only happen when I make myself honest and vulnerable in front of somebody and let them know. You know, I'd really, a big shout out to Corey, man. That was awesome. First talk, dude. Well done, sir. Congratulations. Anyway, so I had that obsessive mind. And so when I took my first drink at like 10 years old, if somebody had left a bottle of backwash on the counter or something, and I drank it and it was nasty, but I got an effect produced by alcohol. A sense of ease and comfort came over me, and immediately I began to obsess about alcohol at 10 years old. By the time I was 15, I drank or used a substitute for a drink every single day. That was the most important thing, being sexually active with girls and boys, and or getting an effect produced by alcohol or substitutes for a drink. That was all I cared about at 15. My parents worked hard to put me into a private school and to give me a special opportunities in life, which meant absolutely nothing to me at that point. And as I said, so at 15, I had a daily obsession to find a drink. And it's not easy to drink every day when you're 15. So the last thing at 15, my parents got a divorce. And being an only child, and I spent a lot of time with my parents, and around adults and everything, that was pretty traumatic. And so I got to be free and do whatever I wanted to do. I was a sponsored skateboarder in Boston. This was in 77. Not a lot of skateboarders in Boston in 77, but I was one of them. But my mother tried to kill herself. And that seemed kind of cool to me in a way. It was, I was listening to Zeppelin and Aerosmith. And it was like the heavy metal days. And that strung out Keith Richards kind of look, you know. And the bad thing about having an obsession for alcohol and substitutes was that because I couldn't stay there 24/7, there was always some downtime where I would have to scrounge for money and scrounge for alcohol and scrounge for stuff. There was always that crash afterwards. And so in a particular moment of crash, Mom tried to kill herself, and this, like, yeah, that was like romantically tragic, cool drama, emo. And so I took a bottle of aspirin. 300 Bufferin, it didn't really do anything. It made my ears ring. I didn't get, nobody found me or Baker acted me. Then my mom tried to shield me from letting the world know that I might have a problem with stuff, and and you know they did the best they could with what was going on at the time. But why I mention that is that it's still with me today. You know, patterns and habits, those things stay with me. And you know, when I'm up against it emotionally today, when the boss puts a pile of work on my desk and I freak out, and you know, mentally in my mind, it's like I don't really think about a drink anymore, because I know that there's no relief in alcohol for me anymore. There's only the promise of more pain. But where my mind goes today when that happens is I think about jumping off the skyway, you know, and that's what happens, you know. So years later, that's 15, I'm 51, you know, it's been a long time that's my sort of go-to, get out of jail free, you know, exit stage left snagglepuss thing is to, screw it, I'm going to jump off the skyway, man. And so I started bouncing around back and forth, mom and dad, went to 5 different high schools, didn't graduate, even, you know, I was always the kid with a lot of potential. I found some of my, like, fourth grade report cards, and they all talked about, you know, Don's so bright and blah, 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 but, you know, he just doesn't do anything, you know. Because truthfully, you know, you can summarize my life is he had a lot of feelings, and he responded to those feelings for the most part, and... You know, today I'm very grateful that a long time back, a fellow who's passed away now, Chucky, he used to come to Monday Night Speakers, and I knew him from Holiday Isles and stuff, an old guy, died with like 45 years or whatever, 50 years. He gave a talk one time, and he talked about some of the old AA slogans, and one of them that has stayed with me is that feelings aren't facts. And as I said, I can look back honestly at my life and realize that I lived my life according to the way I felt. That was the single most important criteria for every decision I made, was how I felt, not knowing that feelings aren't facts. Now, in my recovery, I've had to learn to identify and to recognize and sometimes to hold precious my feelings. They're not trivial. Feelings aren't facts doesn't mean that they're not important, to learn to speak to them directly. Yeah, I'm mad. No, what is it that, you know, I'm not getting that I want, or, you know, that kind of stuff. But the feelings aren't facts. They're important, but they shouldn't be good criteria to make decisions. And that the 12 steps are designed to take me from sensitivity, hypersensitivity to those feelings, to sensibility. You know, to learn to slow down, man. You know, okay, so sometimes my feelings are completely irrelevant to the circumstances, right? How well have I been eating lately? You know, am I taking care of my responsibilities? Do I have extra stress in my life because I'm avoiding stuff I need to handle, et cetera, et cetera? Am I avoiding people, places, and things? You know, have I been sleeping well? Have I been eating well? All those things participate in my emotional health. And so that's why feelings aren't that important anymore. They are important, but they're not. Anyway, so... So I went out to California. I had a chance at 18 to go to California. That was one of my old ideas. The result was nil, but it still was an old idea. That if I could just get away from the neighborhood because all my problems are their fault, if I can go over there, it's going to be totally different. Wait till I get to California. It's going to be amazing. I'm going to be a movie star. I know it. You know, wait till they get a load of me, man. It's amazing. You know, and lots of good intentions. You know, I spent my life trying to sell people, you know, forgetting the reality. I had really good intentions. I was gonna do it, Your Honor. You know, I was gonna. Though I really meant to, honey. I promise. You know, the world doesn't care what my intentions are. You know, the world only cares that I do it or not, that I show up or not. You know, AA has given me a lot of opportunity to practice, stop doing what I want to do, and start doing stuff that I don't want to do. And sometimes it's commitments like this, and I'm afraid, I don't want to go, but I show up anyways. And the more I do that, generally the easier it is, but something spiritual happens from that, I've found, you know. And it's I can't quantify it or describe it, but I believe it's like a, you know, maybe it's a karma thing, I don't know. But something happens when I do that stuff, when I don't do things that I always want to do, because that's all I ever did, was respond to the feelings and did what I wanted to do. And when I do stuff I don't want to do, things that I didn't think would help me, and direction from a sponsor, really, come on, dude, you must have me confused with one of the sick guys. And, you know, that sort of stuff, right? And anyway, so I went out to California, great intentions, it was all going to be different. Of course, it wasn't. You know, I met some young people, I was 18, hey, man, you want a drink? Yeah! Boom, you know, within a week or two, I've recreated Boston in California. You know, the same people, different faces and names, but it's the same people. I'm drinking every day. I get a job, I start stealing from a job. I stole from every job I ever had until I got sober. And, you know, to this day, I occasionally crosses my mind to steal from jobs today, you know. And I don't, though, you know. but it crosses the mind, you know. And so I used to freak out about that, oh, I had that thought, you know, or I thought about a drink. Just, I can't tell anybody in AA, I'm supposed to be sober, you know, I'm supposed to be Mr. AA. And it's like, no, that's not how it works. How it works for me, I don't know how it works for anybody else, but how it works for me is that when I have those thoughts, I don't need to be ashamed or embarrassed. I just need to talk about it. Because once it comes out of my head and gets spoken out loud to somebody else, it loses much of its power. Because so much of the power of the dark side within me is about being in dark, secret places. You know, so I have to put that out, man. I need to just open myself up, make myself vulnerable, expose myself to the world, not literally, but, you know. So, anyways, California was a bust, right? I'm stealing from, you know, everything's madness. So then it's like I had a chance to go to Seattle. It's like, yeah, man, let me get the heck out of L.A. This place is keeping me down. You know, I'm going to go to Seattle. It's going to be amazing. I went to Seattle, same stuff, different day. I came out of Florida, same stuff, different day. Finally, a buddy of mine joined the Navy. He's like, yeah, join the service. I was 20. My dad had been military, and he always talked to me about going in the service. I'm like, yeah, service, that'll fix me. You know, that'll square me away. And no, you know, I just found other guys that like to drink like I did. I couldn't use as many substitutes for a drink because I had random urinalysis, so I just drank more, you know. And I did okay. I am, you know, I have the capacity to learn stuff quickly, and I test well. You know, I don't do any homework or study or anything, but I test well. And so I went through a bunch of electronics training with the Navy, and I tested well, so I kept getting moved on and all that stuff. But then I finally got stationed on a submarine, and I was supposed to go to sea, and I broke up with this girlfriend, and I'm drinking, like, at that point I was drinking Rumpelman's Peppermint Schnapps, so I was drinking like a quarter of that a day. And, you know, it was a mess. I was a train wreck. And I had a lot of stress and depression in my life because I wasn't doing anything I was supposed to be doing. You know, so that kind of creates stress and depression, you know, when you're not, you know, maybe the response wasn't to immediately jump on meds. Maybe I should take a look at the way I'm living my life. And no, can't do that. And so I had a dream where I saw myself hanging from a noose, and I figured God was telling me, dude, it's time to kill yourself. And so, you know, that's how I interpret it, right? And so it's like, well, before I do that, I'm going to have a good time first. So, I went on my little missions, I used to call them, and I wrote a bunch of bad checks, and I took off, and I went AWOL from the Navy, and I went down to California again, went to Mexico, a bunch of, you know, I was living in my car, I was supposed to kill myself, and but that, I didn't have any money, I didn't have any means of killing myself, I didn't know what to do, so I did what I always do, you know, normally it's like, Mom, I mean, you know, leave me alone, I'm a man, you know, I get to live my life, I do whatever I want to, except when I'm in trouble, then it's, Mommy, you know, Mommy, please bring the fresh Pampers, I can't seem to wipe my own butt anymore. And so, Mommy, I turned myself in, got court-martialed, did a month in jail in the Navy. That's where I got first exposed to AA. People had commitments and brought meetings into there. And I remember identifying with the alcoholics and the addicts, the NA meetings. And but, yeah, I'm not that bad, man. I'm a smart guy. I'll figure this out. You know, there's got to be a way that I can switch from scotch to brandy or only drink on the weekends. Or somehow my game has got to be better than theirs. That's the lie I tell myself, right? And, you know, for a very long time, and even into my sobriety this time, the first step, I admitted I was powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable. I didn't even know it, but, you know, I know I can read, and I know what the words say, but I realize now that I internalize that as the man saying, you can't drink. You know, whether the man, the boss, the wife, the mother, you know, some authority figure, you can't drink, you can't party. And that's what I heard. And that isn't what it says, you know. And so if you tell me that I can't do something, my natural reaction is to screw you. That's the first thing I'm going to do. I've always been that way, still to this day sometimes, you know, and if I'm not careful. But what happened was I finally understood when I got sober that powerless over alcohol isn't somebody telling me that I can't drink. It means that whether I want to or not, I'm going to drink. That's the ugly truth, you know. The painful realization was I got scared. I tried my best efforts every way from Sunday, more about alcoholism, that somehow, some way, I can fix this, and I got to that place where I couldn't. Now what? You know, now what? That's when I became sweetly reasonable, and I became just a little willing to follow a couple of small directions. That's all. But, you know, I'm condemned to drink and not to die. You know, I hear that, oh, if I drink, I'll die. I wish. You know, I'm suicidal, dude. No, I've had the privilege in my recovery of working at Turning Point over in St. Pete. And that's a pretty nasty homeless detox, right? And you get sober sleeping on a mat and a floor, and there's no Valiums or anything. And people be flopping all over the place, seizing out, and all kinds of madness. And I got to work there as a case manager for a couple of years, and I got to talk to guys that live under the bridge, that have been under the bridge for 20 years. You know, the guys, they haven't had a bath in a year. They got poop running down their leg, and they're drinking out of a brown paper bag. I've got to talk to those guys. I've got to put rubber gloves on and go and help them shower and stuff. And, you know, most of those guys had been exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous at one time in their life, but they just didn't think they were bad enough. You know, they just thought they'd get it eventually or whatever. Nobody sets out, hey, when I grow up, I want to be the homeless guy under the bridge. You know, that's never the intention. They're all smart guys. Alcoholism's a killer, man. You know, I'm powerless over alcohol. The risk at 20 years sober is probably greater than the guy with a month that I'm going to take another drink. There's no plateaus. I haven't found a place where I can put my feet up now and kick back. This is one day at a time. Give us today our daily bread. I can't rest on my laurels. My mind, you know, I don't have the physical allergy because I haven't had a drink in a long time, but my obsessive mind is just as obsessive as it ever was. You know, the process of going through the steps many times, taking many other men through the steps, outside work, personal growth seminars and all kinds of things the wife and I have done. I've done a lot of peripheral support activities, too, that all support everything that I try to do one day at a time in Alcoholics Anonymous. All those things have yet to remove my obsessive mind. It's still there. What I've come to understand is that I kind of characterize my alcoholism. It's kind of like I was born in the ghetto, mentally, my mind. I'm intelligent, all that stuff, but my mind is like the dope hole. It's the ghetto. That's right. You know, I don't know why. I used to wonder why. I've done some work and therapy and all that stuff to figure out why. That doesn't matter, man. Why doesn't matter? It just is. Water's wet, you know? So I have this mind, right? And so growing up and drinking, I got my butt kicked living in that ghetto mind that I have. Everything I tried to do and try to manage myself and come up with my game and I'll change this and if I just do that and do it right or whatever, you know, somehow it's going to be different, wishing against wishes. I got my butt kicked until finally I started to get sick and tired of getting my butt kicked. And so somebody told me about this place, Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm hesitant, man. Somebody's going to try to run my life and dude, no, even though my life is a wreck when I'm running it, but God forbid I allow another man or woman to try to give me some help with that. But the analogy is that it was the dojo on the corner. It was a karate school. And so I didn't want to go, but I started going anyways, and so they started teaching me some karate, mental karate, like, you know, come to the meeting early and put your hand out and talk to people and help make coffee and help, you know, get a job, get service. You be helpful to anybody you can. If you got one day of sobriety, you can help the next guy walking in, that kind of stuff. And so I started doing it. It felt awkward. It didn't seem to help, and I didn't trust it at all, but I just kept coming anyways because I was desperate. I was getting my butt kicked every day in this ghetto mind of mine, my alcoholism on the street. And so over time, I began to practice this stuff, and eventually, I had a victory against my mind. I actually called a sponsor before I took a drink instead of afterwards. I reached out for help. I took a job, and I did the job that I didn't want to do. I started to have some effectiveness with this stuff. And over time, it's become more effective and more efficient. And that, you know, so what that all boils down to is that I've come to understand the 12 steps and all the peripheral stuff in AA, the support and the service and the fellowship and all the things that I do in AA today. That's like practicing karate. And, it's a discipline. Staying sober for me today and everything that I do as part of my recovery is a discipline. It's a practice. It's just like, Jordan didn't start off as the best basketball player in the world. He probably had some natural abilities in high school. I think, you know, I've read some of that he had some natural skills and stuff, but he still practiced like 5 hours a day. You know, I don't have to practice this stuff 5 hours a day, but I have to be willing to practice it today. Not tomorrow. Tomorrow's a promise that may never come. It's a good intention. It means nothing. The world doesn't give a hoot. But if I'm willing to practice a little bit today, just a little bit, how do you eat an elephant? I can't sit down and eat a whole elephant in one meal, but if I sit down and take a bite at a time, I will consume an elephant over time. And that's how I approach my recovery. So Anyways, I back to the story a little bit. So I got out, let's see, the Navy. I ended up getting kicked out. Luckily, I wasn't dishonorably or bad conducted out, but I had a drinking buddy. After I got court-martialed and stuff, the Navy didn't know what to do with me, and I had a drinking buddy who said, hey, you know, you can ask the Navy for a discharge. And I said, hey, it sounds like a good idea. Screw them. And so I did, and they gave me another than honorable discharge. And I remember, you know, at the time, the guy was like, you know, you take this, you'll never work for the government. And I'm like, screw you, buddy. I would never work for the government. And it's just, you know, and that's important for me to remember because I don't know what I don't know. There's so much stuff that I think I know. You know, when how often do road rage or, you know, I get into arguments with coworkers or even arguments in AA with, oh, the book says this. No, it doesn't. It says this. You know, and how quickly I am to be, you know, so defiant and so determined and so confident on a position when the truth is I don't know the stuff I don't know. I could never know what I didn't know. Like, I know that I know how to drive, right, because I drove a car to get here from St. Pete tonight. I know how to drive. I know that I don't know how to fly airplanes. Never had any flight training, never sat in a cockpit, never flew an airplane. So I know what I don't know. But there's so much other stuff that I don't know that I don't know. I have to be willing to step back from those angry, passionate positions that I want to take and beat other people up, whether it's intellectually or physically. I have to step back from that and allow, wait a minute, man. You know, so there's a great little analogy like that I once heard. I didn't make it up, but so I'm driving down the road, and this car comes flying out of a side street, almost cuts me off, and I'm, you know, screech off, and I'm, you know, cursing the guy out, and I'm chasing after him. I'm going to really give him a piece of my mind, blah, blah, blah. Finally, I pull up. I come up to a gas station on the corner, and I see the guy, and so I pull over, and I'm going to get out and cuss him out and everything, and then as I walk up to him, I see the guy's on the phone. Yes, please, doctor, keep my baby alive another 5 minutes. I'm trying to get there. And here I am ready to, you know, beat him up because he cut me off, not knowing the guy's dealing with, like, a life crisis. And so that's stuff that I don't know about people and the way I live my life and the interactions I have, whether it's on Facebook or in the office or at home with my wife, you know. And so try to slow down, Don. I'm also a Cliff Notes, you know, Monarch Notes, Reader's Digest version kind of guy. Shortcuts, right? Please, you know, stop with the rhetoric. Just get to the chase. Get to the bottom line. What do I need to know? So one of the things, I think like that. And I work against it. Thank you. So one of the things that I've kind of summarized, right? I'm a summarization guy, and I like to think I'm clever. And I've summarized the 12 steps changed my mind. In so many ways, I can look at the process and the mechanics of what I go through as I use the steps in my life today is about changing my mind. Because again, most of the times, my positions that never served me, whether it was not believing in AA or thinking it's a cult and those people can't help me, blah, 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 or, you know, whatever, they're wrong, I'm wrong, we're all wrong, blah, blah, blah. So much of that stuff is based on stuff. I don't have all the information. You know, I have to change my mind. So it's about perception, man. You know, perception today in this world is a commodity. You know, collectively, we're all bombarded with advertising 24/7. Buy this, drink that, wear that, you can be happy. You know, and that it's a lie. I have to change my mind. I have to recognize that if I want to be happy, it begins first by looking in. You know, what is my responsibility? My sponsor is constantly talking to me that if I want to be free, then I have to be responsible. I have to own. You know, I am the creator of my circumstances. I'm not the creator of the earth and the birds and the bees and God, that kind of stuff. But all the circumstances, all the moments, the situations that my life as it plays out, I've created that. Whether it was by choices I made this morning, yesterday, a month ago, 5 years ago, all of those culminate in the here and now. You know, and I used to use that as a tool to think that I'm broken. Screw it. I might as well drink myself to death. I'm a piece of crap, right? But no. But what I've come to see that is empowering, that I get to create something new. If I'm unhappy with my job or with the people or where I'm living or, you know, whatever, if something's going on in the house and I need to talk to my wife about it or whatever, then, you know, I get to change what that looks like by getting honest. Let's talk about it. Step back from the passion and the emotion and just, you know, be reasonable. Detach with love is an Al-Anon thing, and that's a big part of my life today. That's what I'm really practicing on, detaching from everything. You know, detaching from whether my sponsees stay sober or not. I'm not responsible for them staying sober. I'm responsible for responding when they ask for help and giving them love and giving them more often less talk and more listening. Because that's what I need most of the time. I need just somebody to listen. Because the truth is, I usually know the answers to all my problems. I just need to talk it out long enough that I can weed through the selfishness and self-centered objectives and desires to get to what I know is true already. You know? So, let's see. Join the Navy, get out of the Navy. So another old idea that I had, 86 or 84, I get out of the Navy. And so one of my old ideas was that if I just had the right job and had some good clothes and some money in my pocket and a pretty girlfriend and started to, the package on the outside started to look good, then I would have been okay, finally. Whatever that God hole is, or, you know, whatever that pain that I've tried to fill with drugs and alcohol for so long, whatever that was would be solved if I just had stuff and I finally had some bling and I looked like I was cool. And so that was the old idea. And I got out of the Navy, and I stumbled in a job managing a skateboard shop. And things were going really well. Mail order. The internet wasn't around then. It was 84. But mail order was kicking off with the skateboarding stuff. And we were getting, you know, we did really well with that. I've had my picture in, like, Transworld and Thrasher, any skaters in the room. Not because of my skating skills, though, but because I put my picture in the ad in the magazine. That was my claim to fame. You know, there was this one picture where we took a broken board and I made it look like they were breaking it over my head. And so I travel around, you know, hey, you're that skater guy. Yeah, yeah, that's me. Sweet. Whatever. But anyway, so I had all that stuff, and yet I still hated myself. I still felt broken. I still felt like I wasn't cool. They didn't like me, you know, whatever. Now, people might have liked me just fine, but I received that. I felt that they didn't, you know. Feelings aren't facts. You know, I'm trying to go from sensitivity to my feelings to being sensible. How important is it? You know, does it really matter, dude? And do you really know? Have you asked them? Did it, you know? No. And so, anyways, I had all that going on. And I should have been happy according to my old idea, and I still hated myself. And I started drinking more, started doing more substitutes, I started stealing from the job, you know, just like I always did. And finally, the stress of that is impossible to maintain. Suicide crossed my mind again, so I decided, yep, that's the only solution here. And so I stole a bunch of money from the skateboard shop, and I got a jug of wine and a bunch of cocaine, and I climbed up on a tree, and I made a hangman's noose. And I put the noose around my neck, and I said, God, please, you know, I'd been in and out of church, I'd been saved and baptized and all this stuff, I didn't know if I believed in God or whatever, I just prayed, please forgive me, and I jumped out of the tree, and the rope broke, and it was like, wow, you know, I pass out, I come to, I've got poop in my pants, and puked to myself, and I'm, you know, just a wreck, and I was like, who did this to me? I did this to me, you know, because I am the problem. You know, I had a sponsor gave me that sticker. I had it on my bathroom mirror. I shaved it for a long time. That you are looking at the problem. It's not them. It's not them. It's my mind. You know, I have an obsessive mind. That doesn't go away. The tools, AA, the stuff I do around AA, those are the tools that I use to practice the discipline of managing my mind. You know, prayer, meditation, all those things are tools that I use to work with the mind I have. They didn't fix it. They didn't cut it out. You know, I've tried lots of different medications before I got sober. None of that stuff fixed that either. You know, I still have a broken mind, and I probably always will. I've accepted that. It's okay because I have AA, because I have a fellowship, because I have a sponsor, because I know stuff to do to manage that, to let go, to detach with love from stuff, from the outcomes, all those things that I want. You know, I'm not a Buddhist necessarily, but paraphrasing Buddha, desire is the root of all pain. You know, the harder I want something, you know, for a while I got really caught up in The Secret, and, you know, I just got to want it bad enough, and that'll make it happen, and damn it, I didn't win the lottery yet. You know, and so, you know, there's some truth to it, but I have an obsessive, crazy brain, and so whatever's, you know, there may be some truth to this, but I take it to the nth degree, and, you know, it didn't work, right? And so, what happens when after I tried to hang myself, I call my mom, bring the Pampers, and she's like, Yvay, you know, and so I came out on Florida again. I ended up bouncing in and out of meetings. It took me 10 years to finally put the plug in the jug, to surrender, you know. And little did I know that it's a day at a time, that it's 1,000 surrenders a day 1,000 times a day, I still have to change my mind about all kinds of stuff. You know, 1,000 times a day, I have to look at the call from my new guy or whatever, and, oh, I don't want to talk to him right now. Yes, can I help you? How can I be of service to you? Thank you for calling me, you know. It's 1,000 times a day that I have to make decisions like that. This isn't a poof, it's gone. God didn't wave a magic wand and I'm fixed. This is one day at a time. I use the tools or I don't, you know. And as a sponsor used to tell me, well, if you don't want to practice this stuff, suffer, you bastard. And he's right, you know. I mean, you know, I get what I put into it or not, you know. And anyway, so finally, 94, I got married, got divorced. I thought that would fix me, didn't fix me. Because I am the problem, not anybody else, not anything beyond the end of my nose. And I was stealing from a gas station I was working at, like I always did, and, you know, drinking every day, substitutes, all that stuff. And suicide's the only option. I would have blown my brains out. I had the courage to pull the trigger, but I couldn't save $20 to buy a Saturday night special on the street. And I decided I'd jump off the skyway. And I set the alarm to get up and jump off the skyway. I get up in the morning. I'm like, yes! Today's the day I'm going to jump over the threshold, you know, and here we go, and I'm going to get free of this miserable life that I'm a victim of. Wah, wah, wah. And so I went outside to get the newspaper, and it was March 14th, 1994, and it was here in St. Pete, and it was cold, and I'm like, damn it, it's too cold to jump off the skyway. So now I'm panicking, and what am I going to do? And so quickly, I'm racing through my mind. I filled up the bathtub with hot water. I saw that in a movie or something, and drank a pot of coffee, got my heart thumping real good, and I took a serrated steak knife, you know, 4-inch crappy steak knife, and I cut through the arteries in my forearms, and it was like saw, man. It was squirting real good. Splattered all over the bathroom, you know, it was just messy. But then it started to slow down, and I'm like, oh, shit, you know, and what am I going to do now? And so I tried to find my heartbeat, and I put the knife up to my chest, and I punched the steak knife into my chest, and that hurt. And I was like, wow. And I pulled the knife out, and I missed my heart, but I punctured my lung. My lung is collapsing, and, you know, I'm like, the blood, and it's nasty, and I'm praying, like, God, please, you know, whatever, dude. And I passed out. I was waiting for Jesus, and I came to, and all that rage was gone, all the rage that enabled me to be violent to myself. It was like the cartoons, you know. It was like I had an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other, and I just wanted to kill the drunk. The dude, I just wanted to kill the guy that said screw you to the people that tried to help him. I just wanted to kill the guy that said, I'm just doing what I want to do, I'm not hurting nobody, when the truth is I was hurting everybody that ever knew me. Lots of people care about me that it might not be obvious, but I don't care about that, because all I care about is what I want when I want it, and screw you if you're in my way. So I just wanted to kill that guy because I had a conscience. I knew better. My mom and dad taught me right from wrong. I knew I was doing the wrong stuff, and I just wanted to kill that guy. I couldn't stop. And all the rage was gone. I crawled out of the bathtub. I couldn't call mom. Mom had disowned me. My mom's dead now. I'm grateful I got sober and made amends and spent years hanging out playing cards with her like we did before I got into the trouble I created. At one point, my mom had to disown me. She had to slam the door. She wouldn't take my call. That was it. And man, that's a lot of courage. I'm an only child. You know, we were super close. I'm a mama's boy. You know, and my dad had left when I was young, and so for my mom to have the backbone to do that was amazing. Anyways, I got sober, and so I couldn't call mom. I called 911 and ended up at Bayfront, and then they Baker-acted me to PEMS, and then they sent me to USF back then. And 94 had used to have a residential psychiatric unit at Bruce B. Downs called the Florida Mental Health Institute, and I volunteered as a clinical research subject. I was a lab rat, and they were trying different meds on me. How'd that feel, Mr. Turner? Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic, you know. And, a couple of things stuck with me from the 10 years I've been flopping in and out of AA, blaming AA. Oh, that doesn't work. Those cults, you know, they're all cliques, blah, 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 you know, whatever, wah, wah, wah. And I didn't do anything, you know, so it doesn't really work too well if I don't work it. I always looked for somebody to wave a magic wand. That's why I got saved a million times. I wanted Jesus just to wave a magic wand, fix me. Now I don't have to deal with the stupid AA stuff. You know, and but every time I prayed, I ended up in AA. Damn it. So, I ended up at the Mustard Seed. So a couple of things I remembered real quick because I'm running out of time, but they, you know, I remember people said pray. Whether you believe or not, it doesn't matter. Just act as if you do and do it, you know, and that's what we do. And so, you know, I was desperate. I became convinced I'm going to drink until I'm on the street and eating out of dumpsters and all the ugliness that comes with that. I'm scared of that now. I'm motivated. And, you know, and so I have a gift of desperation. So sometimes that's what God is for me. I'm in and out. You know, 5 years ago I got saved again and I became a holy roller for a little while, but today I'm an atheist. But the important thing is I still pray anyways. It doesn't matter. You know, I still do it. Why? Because it's not being a hypocrite. It's because I believe, if anything, it's a discipline. When I pray, I'm letting go of stuff that I don't have any power and control over anyways. I never did. It's just an illusion that I think I have power and control over, but I need to let it go. And so getting on my knees and asking God to help me not drink and to let go of stuff and to say the third step prayer, that helps me to remember that I need to let go of stuff because I never had any control over it anyways. I started going to meetings regularly. First 5 years, I went to a meeting every day because I was scared I was going to drink again. I got involved at service. At 5 years sober, I was Mr. AA. I could get the world sober. I had like 30 jobs in general service. I was overwhelmed, you know, and then I backed away from a bunch of it. Today, I know I need to have a couple of service commitments, which I do, and I just quietly do that, not for fanfare, not for recognition, just because I believe in a piece of the spiritual anonymity in our 12 tradition is about doing stuff without acknowledgement. I don't need to be caught, you know, have the people clap, oh, you did that, thank you so much. No, I just do it because it works. You know, it's about ego deflation at death. I have to change who I am a day at a time. I don't know. I'm really grateful to be sober. Thank you for listening.